Okay, we are reading The Home Ranch by Ralph Moody, published by the University of Nebraska Press. Originally copyright 1956. We're on chapter 5, Picking a String. In a good many ways, horse picking day on the big cattle ranches was like a 4th of July roundup. Horses that had been out on the range or pasture all winter would usually buck when they were saddled for the first time in the spring. The good ones might never buck again all summer, but on that first shakedown, they'd pitch and twist like fury. The older ones, the smartest, were often the hardest to catch and ride. From years of handling cattle, they'd learned every trick of the trade, and some of that were all their own. They knew just as well as the men did that if they could keep from being roped or dumped at their rider, they'd be turned back to pasture for the summer. In other words, they'd have no work to do. A horse string wasn't all that was chosen at the spring picking. Cowboy hands almost always worked in pairs, and that was the time when the new men chose their partners. One man didn't say to another, "Will you be my partner?" He waited until the man he wanted to team up with had ridden into the big corral and roped his first horse. Then he rode into the breaking pen to open the gate, help with the saddling, and stand by as pickup man. Picking the wrong partner could be even worse than picking the wrong horse. And by the time we were all saddled up and Mr. Bachelet was ready to ride in for his number one pick, everybody on the ranch, except the baby, was crowded around the big pole horse corral. The dairy hands were perched along the top rail of the breaking pen like a row of magpies. Mrs. Bent, Jenny, and the smaller girls were peeking through the bars, and Hazel and Kenny were on the top rail of the horse corral with their arms and legs wrapped around the high gate post like a pair of teddy bears. Those of us who were going to do the picking sat on our horses outside the gate, and my heart was pounding like the hoofs of a stampeding herd. I knew how much I was going to need good horses that summer, and I knew I'd made a bad mistake in telling Mr. Bent I didn't want his help. I was determined to get Blue Boy, but didn't have any more idea than a goose what other horses to pick. I think everyone was holding his breath when Mr. Bachelet rode into the corral. The second he unlimbered his rope and started it swinging, the horses began to mill and dodge. Before I had any idea which one he was after, his line whistled out, and the loop settled around the neck of the seal brown mare Sid had pointed out to me. She seemed to have known she was going to be chosen and came out of the milling bunch without ever tightening the rope. When Mr. Bachelet turned her toward the breaking pen, Mr. Bent was there to open the gate. "Easy, Starlight," was all he said as the mare crowded past him. Starlight bucked hard, quick, and for only 5 or 6 seconds. Anyone who knew anything about horses could see that she and Mr. Bachelet understood each other perfectly, and that one was having as much fun as the other. He never left the saddle far enough that a piece of paper could have been slipped under him, and when he led the mare out through the gate, she nuzzled his shoulder. Hank had drawn number 2 and was barely inside the corral when he spurred straight at a high-headed bay gelding. It looked to be an easy catch, but the bay bolted away as the loop flew. So did the rest of the bunch, with Blue Boy in the lead and Hank spurring close behind, swearing at the bay and gathering his rope back in. He let his second loop fly before it was half-built, and it closed before it reached the bay. His third loop was nearly as big as a circus tent. It fell short to the bay and snagged an old black mare. Everyone knew she wouldn't buck, and no one went into the breaking pen to help Hank saddle her. Mr. Bachelet hardly excited the bunch at all when he took Starlight out, but Hank had driven them half crazy. Sid's turn followed Hank's, and I knew he'd go for the tall sorrel, but I was worried about who would go in to open the bucking pen gate for him. I wanted to do it myself, but it would have taken a lot of nerve for a boy to pick himself as a man's partner. I didn't even look towards Sid when he started to ride in for his first pick, but just sat on Lady looking at the excited horses in the corral. As he rode past me, there was a sharp sting on my hip pocket. When I jumped and looked around, Sid grinned and jerked his head toward the breaking pen. I couldn't have been happier if somebody had given me $1,000. Sid didn't make much work of getting his rope on the sorrel and led it toward the bucking pen by the time I was there to open the gate. It bucked hard and fast, but Sid was a fine rider and stuck like a burr. Zeb had drawn number 4, but didn't even bother to ride his mule into the corral. Blue Boy was driving the remuda in a racing merry-go-round, but Zeb slouched into the corral as unconcerned as if he'd been going to the well for a bucket of water. He stood with his loop dangling at his side, and when the horse he wanted passed him, he flipped the rope over its neck. The horse was the smallest in the corral, and he didn't show a bit of fight. But Hank was at the breaking pen gate, pushing it open and shouting, "Hold him, Zeb! Hold him! Head him this way so as I can give you a hand." My turn was next, and I was so busy thinking about the way I'd try to handle Blue Boy that I didn't notice Hazel until Sid came to open the gate for me. She was sitting on the top rail and had her arm wrapped around the gatepost just above my head. I was starting to shake a loop in my catch rope when she reached out a toe and just touched me on the shoulder. When I looked up, she whispered, "If I thought you could ride good enough, I'd tell you to pick Clay." "Maybe I'll pick him on the second go-round," I whispered back. "I've already got one all," she sniffed. "A little boy like you probably couldn't handle Clay anyways. He's mighty quick." If she'd called me growing up, I wouldn't have flown mad so quick about her calling me a little boy. But with her, I couldn't help it. "Which one is he?" I snapped at her. "We'll see if I'm good enough to handle him." Hazel didn't look at me, and she didn't look at the horses, but off toward the dairy barn. Her lips hardly moved as she said, "The little Clay Bank with the black stripe down his back." I'd been nervous when I was sitting there on Lady waiting to go in and make my try for Blue Boy. But if my hands were shaking when Sid opened the gate corral for me, it was because I was so mad I couldn't hold him still. I crowded Lady right in before the gate was open more than a yard, shook out my loop, and looked to see where the little Clay Bank was. I noticed him that morning when he dodged past Blue Boy and led the remuda out of the S Canyon. But all I remembered about him was that he ran with the slow bunch and had a short hoppity hop gait, saddle scars on his back, and carried his head low. I didn't want him at all, but I wasn't going to let Hazel think I couldn't handle him. The bunch was still excited and jumpy, and I didn't help things any by spurring Lady into the corral so fast. The first thing I knew, I had a merry-go-round going, and the Clay Bank was right in the center, sort of dodge-hopping along, with his head low and tight against the rump of a big bay. If I'd been on his back, I couldn't have got a rope around his neck. I was sure I hadn't made any move that would let the Clay Bank know I was after him, but he watched me like a gopher. I let the bunch make 3 or 4 circles while I just sat there with my rope swinging easy. Then I spurred Lady hard and straight into the merry-go-round. As the horses wheeled away, the Clay Bank's head came loose from the bay, and I wanged my loop down at it. It was one of the best throws I'd ever made, but the Clay Bank ducked his head, and my loop slithered across his mane. It had barely touched the ground when I heard Mr. Bent shout, "Hazel, you get down off in that fence. Get on over with your ma where you belong." It must have been nearly 10 minutes before I got another chance to make a throw at the Clay Bank. Of course, after my first throw, he and everybody else knew I was after him, and he kept his head tucked up against some of the horses so tight I couldn't shake him loose. Hank kept shouting orders at me, and I think it was his shouting that made me miss my second throw. I let the loop go, and I didn't have more than half a chance. When I gathered in my rope, I was so nervous that it came up wiggling like a snake. My mouth was dry, and there was a lump in my throat that was half choking me. I knew I was doing a little boy sort of a job right out there in front of everybody, and that Hazel was probably snickering at me. I had to sit there for a minute or two, trying not to hear what Hank was yelling, and trying to make up my mind whether or not to dab my loop onto the first horse would make me an easy catch. One more miss, and I'd lose my turn altogether. As I sat there, I built a new loop and was swinging it sort of lazy-like when Hazel yelled, "Now! Now!" I woke up as if I'd been dreaming, and the first thing I saw was the little clay bank dog hopping past me. He had his head turned my way and was looking at me as if, as much to ask if I'd given up. Without even thinking, I whipped my loop over Lady's ears, yanked it down hard. It came tight around the Clay Bank's neck. Sid was grinning like a jack-o'-lantern when he opened the breaking pen gate and let us through. As I passed in the catch, he asked, "Know what one you got?" "Sure," I said, "the one I went after." "Dogged if you didn't, but I'll bet you a hat you don't know what one it is." "I ought to," I told him. I had a hard enough time getting a loop on him. Then I added, "With Hazel's help." "Bet she gets her biscuits warmed," he chuckled. "This here is her old man's prize cutting horse. Watt's been chewing on his knuckles ever since the picking began. Scared somebody dab a rope on before his turn come up." "Then I'm going to turn him back," I said. "I didn't know he was a special horse." "No, you ain't neither," Sid snapped. "What? What? He wouldn't let you batch neither. Now you get on outside and haul that Hess saddle off. You still got a devil of riding to do afore you get a claim on this level, little devil." I did a lot of thinking as I took off my spurs, uncinched my saddle, and pulled it off Lady. In the first place, it wasn't very fair for Hazel to have told me about picking Clay. And in the second place, I'd be in a bad way if I had Mr. Bent sort me. By the time I got back to the breaking pen, I had my mind made up about what I was going to do. If the clay bank bucked hard enough to give me any excuse at all, I'd use one of the tricks I learned for the Littleton Roundup. I'd flip out of the saddle, somersault, and land sitting down. I could do it without being hurt, and it would be hard for anybody to see that I hadn't been throwing. After what Hazel had said about my not being good enough to handle clay, I didn't like to be the first one tossed, but it seemed to be my only way out of a lot of trouble. I must have buttoned my lips tight when I made up my mind. When I was climbing the fence with my saddle, Sid snapped, "Get that look off in your pan and them ideas out of your head. You wouldn't be fooling nobody if you took a flop Piru. You wouldn't be doing yourself no good. Hist that saddle over here and haul your belt up tight." Clay didn't make a move when the cinches were pulled tight or when I eased into the saddle. I didn't think he was going to buck at all. But before Sid turned him loose, he half whispered, "Watch out for him. He ain't going high, but he'll be a sidewinding son of a gun and quicker than scat. Hold your hat in your hand and keep it up high. You'll need all the balance you can get out of it." I didn't have time to do much thinking, and I couldn't have flipped out of the saddle on purpose to save my neck. It was only what Sid told me about holding my hat high that saved me a dozen times. Clay never went more than a foot off the ground, and he didn't bog his head enough to give me a light line to hold. He didn't sunfish, and he didn't swap ends, but he did every double shuffle, fence row, and zigzag in the book, and some that weren't. I don't think the seat of my pants was square in that saddle for a tenth of a second after Clay's first sideslip. Twice I was so off balance that I could see the ground between my own two legs. But both times, just when I thought I was a goner for it, Clay changed direction and snapped the saddle back under me. I don't suppose he put on more than a 10-second show. Nobody could have really called it bucking. But it seemed to me like an hour. When he swung around to the gate and stopped, he turned his head and looked at me as if he were saying, "Well, you made it, didn't you, kid?" Everybody, even the dairy hands, were crowded around the breaking pen when Sid opened it and let me ride Clay out. Hazel was hopping up and down, and half a dozen were talking at the same time. But I was only listening for Mr. Bent. "Reckon you know what you done to me," he said with a laugh that didn't have any music in it. "Dang near put me afoot. That's what you done. Figured I had a chance right up to the last hop. You wasn't on by more'n a boot heel." Then he slapped Mr. Batchelet on the back and hooted, "By dog, did you take note of all the air he beat with that Stetson? Looked like a dad-gummed hawk fighting a coyote with one busted wing." Anybody could see how badly Mr. Bent felt and that he was just trying to cover up by hooting and making a joke. I didn't feel a bit good myself. Even though I'd stayed on clay, I'd only proved that Hazel was right when she said I probably couldn't handle him. I hadn't wanted the horse in the first place, and I wished I could find some way of turning him over to Mr. Bent. I was sitting there on the clay bank with my head down thinking when Mr. Batchelet slapped me on the leg and said, "Get your feathers up, boy. Between you and Hazel, you earned him fair and square. He'll dump you plenty of times, but you'll probably learn to ride him." He started away, then turned back and said quiet enough that no one else could hear, "You understand, Little Britches, that by picking this horse, you picked yourself one of the toughest jobs in the outfit, and there won't be nobody coming to help you." "Yes, sir," I said, "I know it." I really didn't until that minute, but I couldn't say so. I rode Clay around a little after Mr. Batchelet talked to me, and he was as easy to handle as Lady. I was so excited about having him that I didn't pay too much attention to the picking and shaking down until it was almost my turn for the second go-round. All I noticed was that no one had picked Blue Boy. Everyone ahead of me had used his first pick to go in after his second. His first pick horse to go in after his second. When Zeb went in, I rode Clay up to wait for my turn. I was sitting there on him, just outside the corral gate, thinking about how I'd catch Blue Boy when I saw Hazel run to her father. He leaned down, and she seemed to be whispering to him for a minute. Then she came running over to me. When I leaned down, she whispered, "Take Pinch." "If I don't take Blue Boy this time, somebody else will get him," I whispered back. That time, Hazel looked right up in my eyes. She shook her head hard and said, "Uh-uh, you take Pinch. You'll need him." After Hazel's having picked Clay for me, and especially after her having helped me catch him, I couldn't tell her to mind her own business. So I said, "All right, which one is he?" "Well," she said, "he's Bay, and he's a little bit jug-headed and not very pretty, but there he goes, right behind that silver tip." I'd seen plenty of Pinch when I'd been trying to catch Clay and had told myself he'd be the last horse in the remuda I'd ever pick. He looked old and bony and homely and lazy and was about the meanest gelding I'd ever seen. He kept his ears pinned down tight, and every time another horse got in front of him, he'd snake his neck out and bite it on the rump. The remuda was running in a merry-go-round, and I took Clay into the corral real slowly, planning to make a flip catch the first time Pinch passed. But he didn't go past. He dropped out of the circle and nipped his way into a bunch that was jammed in the far corner. I'd hardly looked toward Pinch, and don't know how in the world he knew I was after him, but he did, and so did Clay. Both of them knew a lot more about the whole business than I did. Pinch turned to face us squarely as I rode toward the corner. One after another, the other horses dashed away, but he didn't move a muscle, and Clay never once turned his head toward the others. He slowed his gait, and under me felt like a cat looks like when he's creeping up on a ground squirrel. I couldn't very well make a flip catch with Pinch facing right at me, so I began to whirl my loop slowly and must have glanced up at it. In that split moment, Pinch dodged to get away, and quicker than the whip pop of whip, Clay dived to stop him. If I hadn't grabbed for the saddle horn faster than I could think, he'd have spilled me. As it was, I dropped my coil and the loop fell dead. I'd have lost my catch rope altogether if the end of it hadn't been tied to the saddle horn. I was even more ashamed of myself for grabbing the horn than for wasting a throw and dropping my rope. Neither horse moved until I had the rope coiled again and had begun to swing my loop. As it came forward on the fourth swing, I yanked it down hard at Pinch's head. But his head wasn't there, and I came awfully near to not being there either. In the split fraction of a second it took that loop to strike, Pinch snaked his head away and dodged to one side. Clay dodged right with him, and I had to grab for the saddle horn again. I don't think Pinch ever moved his hind feet, but he kept feinting and dodging with his front ones, and Clay feinted and dodged a little quicker. He didn't pay any more attention to me than if I'd been a sack of rags, and that's just about the way I rode him. More than half the time, I was half out of the saddle, and the only way I could stay in it was by keeping a death grip on the horn. Hank was yelling orders at me. I could hear the men hooting and laughing, but the two other horses kept feinting so fast I couldn't get my balance long enough to coil in my rope. I must have slid back and forth across my saddle 1,000 times before I had sense enough to pull Clay away from that corner, so he just stands still long enough for me to think. I knew I'd lost my head in trying to handle Pinch, and I guess that's what made me think of Hyde Beckman. At the YB, he was always telling me, a man that loses his head loses his horse. Don't never tackle a horse till you've watched him and know his quirks. When I'd sat still and thought a couple of minutes, I was sure I knew how to catch Pinch, and it worked just the way I thought it would. I whirled my rope, drove him out of the corner and into the merry-go-round, then crowded him until he caught up to the slowest runners. He did what I knew he'd do, snaked his head out to nip the horse in front of him on the rump. My loop caught him when he was looking where he was going to nip. Pinch behaved all right when I led him to the breaking pen, but Sid didn't. When I was swinging out of my saddle, he fanned my behind with his hat as if he thought I'd burned it when I was sliding around on Clay. He didn't say a word, but he didn't have to. The men howled and hollered like a pack of moonstruck coyotes. I didn't look at anybody when I rode Clay out and stripped off my saddle and was halfway back to the breaking pen with it when Mr. Bashley called, "Hey, how about them spurs? Better leave them on the outside." With everybody laughing at me and having to go back to take off my spurs, I was a little careless about the way I saddled old Pinch. He blew his belly up like a balloon when Sid was passing the cinch to him, and I didn't notice he was still holding his breath when I yanked the cinch tight and set my knot. "Better hold off a minute and tighten that cinch again," Sid told me as I started up the poles to mount. "He's still as swole as a bloated calf." I'd fussed around and been laughed at enough, and I wasn't going to wait and let people think I was afraid to get on Pinch. Besides, I didn't think the old horse would any more than crow hop. "He's just hay belly, that's all," I said, balanced at the top rail, and eased myself down into the saddle. I found out how hay belly Pinch was in less than 2 seconds after Sid turned him loose, and I found out what kind of crow hopping he did. That old horse went at the job of unloading me the same way a man would go at chopping wood, except that he made a quarter turn between every downstroke. He didn't move either forward or backward. Each jump was just like the one before it, and he didn't hurry. With a tight saddle, any man, if he had a stout enough neck and backbone, could have ridden him all day without being thrown. But I didn't have any of them. Pinch let out a big groan and a barrel full of air on his first jump. And from then on, the saddle rolled around him like the skin on a cat. With every thud and turn, it slipped farther forward and to one side, and I got dizzier and dizzier. It would have been a disgrace to grab the saddle horn, but I couldn't even do that. It was way around where my right knee should have been, and I had to kick my feet out of the stirrups. I don't remember much of anything after the first half dozen jumps, but when pinch stopped, I had a death grip on his mane, his mane with both hands, and my legs were clamped in front of his shoulders like a collar. At first, there wasn't a sound outside the breaking pen. But then, the men started laughing again when Sid picked me off, and I heard Mr. Benton hoot, "Bud diggity, I'd say he's a trick rider. That kid sure got a riding style all his own." The lump came back into my throat, and I was sure I'd made such a fool of myself that I'd always be a joke around the place. But Mr. Batchelor was waiting when I led Pinch out of the pen. He put his hand on the back of my neck and rubbed it around a couple of times good and hard. Then he said, "I could have told you what would happen before you climbed aboard, but I reckon it was best to let the horse learn you. Now, you'll remember to double-check your gear before you step foot in the stirrup. You ought to do all right this summer if you can learn to ride him. You got two right smart horses." I still didn't think much of old Pinch, but I nodded and said, "Yes, sir, and I think I'll remember." When my turn was coming up for the third go-round, I kneed the last breath out of air out of Pinch and hauled my cinch strap as tight as I could get it. Blue Boy still hadn't been picked, and I didn't want to take a chance with a slipping saddle when I went after him. Hazel hadn't come near me since I'd made that terrible ride on Pinch's neck, but she was walking over when we were waiting outside the corral. She didn't mention the ride or the way I'd slipped and slid around on clay, but asked, "Which one are you going to pick this time?" "Blue Boy," I told her. "Fiddle TD," she said with her nose wrinkled up. "He ain't got any more sense than a jackrabbit. Look at him. Four white feet and a white nose. Haul off his hide and feed him to the crows. Why don't you pick Juno?" "Because I want Blue Boy," I told her. "Why?" "Because I like him," I said. "Isn't that enough?" "Humph. 'Tis for you, I reckon," she snapped and started away toward her mother. But then she flung back over her shoulder. "But you'll be sorry to the very longest day you live." "If I'm sorry, it'll be because I got this crabby old Jughead," I snapped back at her. But when I rode into the corral, I wasn't as sure as I had been that I wanted Blue Boy. He'd been getting more and more excited as the picking went on, and he was no longer running with the bunch, but dashing this way and that, ripping at the other horses and driving them out of his way. If I hadn't had that little tiff with Hazel, I'd have tossed my rope onto a neat-looking pinto mare that caught my eye. But if I'd done it, everybody would have known I was letting Hazel boss me around. I just about had to take Blue Boy, whether I still wanted him or not. If cow horses aren't mind readers, they're awfully close to it. I'd hardly made up my mind that I had to take Blue Boy before Pinch knew it. He didn't pay the least attention to any other horse in the corral, and he surprised me half out of my skin. I'd just set my loop whirling when Blue Boy made a wild dash past us. The cantle of my saddle came up and spanked me across the seat of my pants, then it snapped to the side. I don't suppose it took me a tenth of a second to catch my balance, or I'd have gone flying. But in that split instant, old Pinch had pulled the throttle wide open. He was racing stride for stride with Blue Boy and holding him in against the pole fence at my right. All I had to do was let my loop drop over his head. I could have made the catch just as easy with a barrel hoop. Every other horse had cooled down right down when it felt the rope around his neck, but Blue Boy went wild. He reared, struck with his forehoofs, then whirled and charged away. Pinch whirled to face him and half-squatted, almost like a dog sitting down. The rose whizzed out like a whiplash, and Blue Boy was the cracker when he reached the end of it. Pinch didn't budge an inch when the rope twanged tight against the knot on the saddle horn, but Blue Boy did a flying somersault and landed on his back. He was still groggy when he lurched to his feet and let me lead him to the breaking pen. I think all the men had expected another show when I rode in to make my third pick, and I don't believe one of them expected me to take Blue Boy. I guess it happened so fast that it took everybody as much by surprise as it did me. As Sid swung the bucking pen gate open, he yapped, "What in the blazing?" Mr. Batchelet came up to the fence and called out, "Watch that horse, Sid. He's treacherous." "Ain't it best I turn him back?" Sid asked. "He picked him. Leave him learn his lesson," Mr. Batchelet said in a hard, dry voice. "But watch out when you saddle up and hang in close for a pickup when the kid mounts." Blue Boy was still acting half stunned and hardly made a move when Sid hauled the cinch tight. Sid had his mouth open, clamped as tight as he pulled the cinch, and he didn't open it until I was balanced on the top rail, ready to ease into the saddle. He'd taken the hackamore from his own rig, put it on Blue Boy, and let the noseband out until it was only a couple of inches above the nostrils. As he passed me the hold rope, he said, "See them scars across this Blue Devil's muzzle? Them's hackamore scars. He's got a tender nose bone. Keep your hold rope hauled in up tight so he can't neither bog or hist his head. Don't try to grab a holt of nothing when you get throwed. Then I eased into the saddle, found the stirrups, and Sid drew his horse away to turn us loose. Blue Boy went up like a geyser and came down running and crow hopping. He didn't twist or side jump, and I'd ridden yearling calves that were harder to stay on. After three crow hopping, bouncing turns around the breaking pen, he settled into a fairly even gait. I was sitting in the saddle, sort of loose-jointed, thinking what I was going to say to Hazel when Blue Boy suddenly busted wide open. He caught me when I wasn't ready, and I didn't have a chance. From the instant of his first side jump, I bounced around the saddle like a pea in a gourd. I forgot what Sid had told me about keeping the hackamore tight and couldn't even hold an arm out for balance. Both arms and both legs were flailing, and I was flying in midair when Sid's arm looped around me and caught me and pulled me across his horse's neck. I don't think even Blue Boy even missed me. He kept right on pitching as if he were trying to throw the saddle over the moon. The wind was knocked out of me so much I couldn't talk when Sid gathered me in, but he could. He spluttered at me like an old setting hen wanting to know why in the world I'd picked Blue Boy in the first place, why I hadn't been watching out for tricks, and why I didn't take a dive when he caught me napping. There weren't any good answers, and I didn't try to give any. It seemed as if I'd made a monkey of myself with everything I tried to do all afternoon, and I didn't feel very happy when Sid let me slide down the gate. If I could have slipped away, climbed on the lady, and headed for home, I think I'd have done it. Blue Boy was still kicking and bucking, and Mr. Bashett looked pretty sore when he opened the gate and came in. "Well, young fella," he said, "you picked yourself a big handful, didn't you? What are you going to do with him now you've got him?" "I haven't got him," I said. "He had me thrown clear when Sid grabbed me." "Rode out your count, 10 count, didn't you?" "Yes, sir," I said. "But then he wasn't bucking like, then he's yours. You going to ride him or ruin him?" For a second, it seemed as if the bottom had dropped out of my stomach and my mouth went dry as powder. The first thought that crossed my mind was that Mr. Bashett was sore at me for having picked Blue Boy and that he wanted me to get hurt. I hadn't been so scared since the first time I was dumped off a horse, and I think that's what saved me. That first tumble came back to me in a flash. It had been when I was 8 years old. Father had picked me up, caught the horse, and told me to get back on. "Unless you show him who's boss right now, it will ruin you both," he told me. "He'll lose respect for you, and you'll lose respect for yourself." When I'd hung back and told him I was afraid, he'd said, "You don't have to be ashamed of that. Every man who ever did a brave thing was afraid. It doesn't take courage to do the things you're not afraid of." It seemed almost as if I could hear Father's voice again. I looked up at Mr. Bachelet and said, "I'll ride him now, and thank you." He slapped me on the shoulder and called, "Get a rope on that blue devil, Sid. We got a bronc twister coming up." There wasn't any rope bronc twisting to my second ride on Blue Boy. He'd nearly bucked himself out in trying to unload the saddle. I kept the hackamore pulled tight, and he came only about 10 straight forward pitches before he came to a stand. Even Hazel came over to the gate to meet us when I rode Blue Boy out of the breaking pen, and she was still snippy. The first chance she got, she turned up her nose at me and said, "Well, you got him, Smarty, but you'll be sorry." When Mr. Bent was in the corral for his third pick, Mr. Bachelet came and stood beside me. "You've got more horse there than a boy of your age ought to have," he told me. "And I reckon I'm out of my head to let you keep him. He's headstrong as a mule, tougher than bull beef, and can't be trusted. Don't you go trying to ride him without there's another of us close by." I just nodded my head. We stood there for a couple of minutes, watching Mr. Bent catch Juno, the neat pinto mare I'd had my eye on, and the one Hazel had told me to pick. Then Mr. Bachelet squeezed my shoulder a little quick grab and said, "I know how you feel about him, little britches. Felt the same way about his old man when I was younger. Greatest wild horse ever I laid eyes on." He rubbed a hand along Blue Boy's sweaty neck, smiled, and said, "Reckon maybe that's why I ain't give up on this worthless son of a gun." It was so late when we finished the horse picking that Mr. Bachelet decided not to send the rest of the remuda to the mountain ranch till morning. And I was glad of it. I hadn't really been hurt at all, but I'd been thumped and twisted around till I ached all over. As soon as we'd had supper, I made a beeline for my bunk. Okay, love you. And that's the end of our chapter.